Les colloques du Collège de France.
Our second speaker this morning is Nathan Wildman from the University of Tilburg. He's assistant professor there. And the title of his talk is When is a Work Immersive?
Cool. Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? If I just talk like this, to like go much. Hi. And it's like, I kind of find that very awkward and weird. I don't know what I do. So first thing to say is thank you very much for the invitation. It's super nice to be here again. The second thing to say is I'm going to go totally off script. This is supposed to be a metaphysics and epistemology conference. I'm going to talk about aesthetics, and basically this is somewhere between a philosophy and a game studies talk. So, hey, cool, I just lost most of the room. That's amazing. I want to start with an anecdote, kind of Freudian a little bit, but everything good and bad in my life comes back to my mother. So, that's my mom on the head there. And actually, this is kind of close to it's an anecdote that ties in with something that Vince mentioned a few minutes ago. So my mom came to visit me when I was working in Glasgow, and kind of desperate to find something to kind of keep her entertained, we took her over to Neil's VR lab, and we strapped her into a VR situation. It actually was, you move around in the Sierra Nevada, it's very close to where she really lives, and she really enjoyed it, found it a lot of fun. Notably, it's one of those VR situations where you don't move. Like, if you move, it doesn't really impact anything. You move by jumping, right? You pick a point, and then it kind of just, like, teleports you to the place. It's important. Also, she didn't have any headphones on. She just had the headset. So we're standing in Neil's, at the time, office, which was on the corner. You could hear the traffic go by. She was talking to us. We were talking to her. We could see what she was seeing. She's standing on the edge of a cliff, right? And again, you know, very Freudian, to torture my mother. I said, okay, Mom, take a step forward. Again, she knew. She was still in the office. She was talking to us the whole time. She starts shaking. She can't do it. She says, I just can't. And I come back and treasure that memory a lot. But what I want to talk about kind of stems from this. And I'm interested in what the hell happened there, right? What was going on? And I think, so there's a terminological minefield here, but I think that the most natural explanation is to say something like, my mom was, too, immersed in the VR situation, right? That is, right, she knew, she believed that she was in the office, believed she was safe sound, she believed that actually moving in the space wouldn't impact anything in the virtual environment, and yet, the visual field was so immersive that she simply could not overcome that. That's like a natural explanation. And I think something like this is what you often hear that VR is disoriented. So Neil and I have a slide that we use in a bunch of our talks, goes through. It's disorienting in the sense that it doesn't help you kind of orient yourself in the real world. Contrast that maybe with a bunch of AR, right? AR is usually oriented. Not always, but. So, I want to kind of think about being immersed. So I went and read a bunch of literature, the philosophy literature on immersive experiences. And it was very striking to me that the literature, very, very broad, it's largely focused on something like, I'm going to call it the broadly cognitive nature of immersion, in particular, imaginative immersion. So here's a bunch of different references, just some of and honestly, what I found was there's a lot of accounts of imaginative immersion that kind of agree on something, like so much with philosophy, right? They kind of agree on some things, they disagree on some things. There are reasons to favor one, reasons to favor another. But frankly, it didn't really seem to me like there was any good winner here. They were all kind of jammed up. What was really weird, though, was I didn't really find much on the idea of when a work is immersive. So it was always coming at it from this kind of, let's call it mental, psychological, phenomenal perspective, and never really looking at it from the thing. And that's very weird to me, because when you just, when I go and do stuff in narratology or game studies and things like this, there's a lot of this kind of thing. At least I tend to find in people talking in terms of the work's immersive features. And if we think about it, we're very happy in everyday life to ascribe immersiveness to a wide range of, I'm going to just spoil it, fictions, in this Foucauldian sense, we'll talk about that in a minute, of media types. We'll talk about literature being immersive, we can talk about visual art being immersive, video games, AR and VR applications. Again, I think that was something very close to what we were just talking about. Pieces of music, sport can be immersive. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. I think these are all broadly in the same, I think whatever phenomenon's going on is basically the same thing in all of these cases. At least that's sort of what I want to think about. But again, I want to flip it. I don't want to think about the experiences, I don't want to think about it from the kind of person perspective, but think about the works here. And I'm using work very broadly. So my aim in the next, let's call it half an hour, is to think about the notion, I'm going to call it work immersiveness. Word, immersiveness. But again, looking at the features of works and asking, okay, what are the relevant features of an immersive work? What does it need to be like in order to be immersive? And I think it's actually really fruitful to look at this phenomenon of immersion from this sort of work-first direction, rather than the kind of psychological or mental top-down. I think one thing is, thinking about it this way offers a lot of value for would-be artists or designers. So this is actually something I think that comes up occasionally in philosophy of technology. I also think it drives home the idea that immersiveness is a broadly aesthetic property, which is something I buy into. It's going to be a higher order aesthetic property, but something like that there. And I think also maybe putting it this way is going to help us move away from some of the loggerheads we end up at when we think about understanding or offering an analysis of imaginative immersion. Basically, to go back a slide, the kind of thing that I found when I was going through the literature there. And lastly, as a kind of weird, sub-useful, helpful thing, I think it might give us some stories to tell about non-works that induce similar immersive states, so things like sport, or maybe even if you're really into writing your philosophy paper, right, you can have something like a sense of immersion. You know, when everything's, but I haven't had this feeling in years, but I'm sure, you know, some people do, I've heard. So I think this is something, again, useful when we think about the activity, the thing that you're doing, rather than what's going on in your head, broadly speaking. And the story I want to get to is that a work is immersive when its features facilitate satisfying relevant prescriptions to make believe. So basically, the upshot is going to be take a Waltonian conception of works and what we're doing when we engage with works, and an analysis of various forms of work immersiveness. I say analysis, that is way too big a word. Basically, what I'm going to do is throw a bunch of different ways works can be immersive at you. That's what I'd like to deliver. What I'm probably going to deliver, we'll see. Hopefully it's at least entertaining. And I think, so just before I go on, one reason why I like this kind of story, again, to link back to this similar immersive states in non-works, is you can just kind of change this bit, right? And that works really nicely, I think. Okay, so here's the plan. I'm going to start off by talking to you about Waltonian conceptions of fiction. We've kind of covered this already, so this is familiar territory, but doesn't hurt to hear it again. Then I want to talk about some features that I take work immersiveness has. And if I remember right, I'm going to talk about four? Let's call it four. We'll see what happens when we get there. Then once we have those kind of in the background, I'm going to talk about five different ways that I think works can be immersive. I'm going to pull these apart, and I think thinking about the five different ways will help us, again, drill down and think about how works can have this sort of property. And I want to finish by talking about some funny cases. And as always, we're going to come back, at the very end, we'll come back to my mother. So, she's the specter that haunts me. Okay, so, the Waltonian conception. Again, this is hopefully familiar stuff, but Ken Walton famously came up with this story that's meant to be an account of our engagement with representational works, not just hard works, but works more generally. And his idea is that whenever we're engaging with representational works, we're playing something like a game of make-believe. It's worth noting, and I think this kind of came up yesterday, Walton doesn't really tell us a lot about what he takes make-believe to be. So it's kind of fast and loose. But the idea is that when we're engaging with works like this beautiful thing here, like we're basically doing the same thing that we used to do when we were kids and we would play pure imaginative games, right? So we play cops and robbers. The typical example is the bear stump case, right? If you see a stump, you're prescribed to imagine that it's a bear. Okay, or another one is very easily, right? Imagine there's a bear in the room. Okay, go. Basically, he thinks we're doing the same things. Importantly, these games of make-believe are not, according to him, completely chaotic. It's not, to drop a reference, Calvin Ball. Are people familiar with Calvin Ball? Calvin Ball is from Calvin and Hobbes, famous comic strip. Importantly, the only rule with Calvin Ball is you can't use the same rule twice. So it's completely madness. The game degenerates very quickly. Well, according to Walton, games of make-believe aren't like that. They're constrained. The make-believing, there's some that are proper, appropriate in certain contexts and others not. So what does the constraints? Here's the big thing. Props and principles of generations. Props are things, real things, objects whose existence and features are used to guide and determine the features and prescriptions to make-believe. The bear stump game. Where the stumps are, that tells you where the bears are. The stumps are the props. Another very easy one, right? Our bear puppet. The color of the bear puppet tells you what color you're prescribed to imagine the bear to be. You're doing it wrong if you imagine that he is a polar bear. Or maybe he's a polar bear who's, you know, gotten slightly worried about his grayness and dyed his hair. Figure out. So props are things that help to guide. Along with the props, you have principles of generation. These are basically the rules to the game. They're rules that fix prescriptions. They can be explicit. Imagine there's a bear in the room. They can be conditional. If you see a stump, then you're prescribed to imagine it's a bear. They can have a bunch of different forms. Notably, they can also only be implicitly understood. So it might be such that we're all playing a game of make-believe and you don't necessarily know what the rules are yet. Maybe because we're making them as we go and we fix them all. Or maybe because you walked in late and you didn't get the beginning. You're picking up the game as you go. They also need not be something that you can explicitly articulate. Might just be too complicated for you to be able to spell out. That's not going to be so useful for me here, but it will be helpful for me, so I wanted to say it now. So what we get with these two is a definition of something like a Walt fiction. A Walt fiction is a work whose function is to serve as a prop in a game of make-believe. Notably, this is a new technical definition of fiction. It is way wider than the kind of thing we typically talk about. Because it's going to include a lot of things. Paintings, puppets, dolls, traffic signs? How far it goes is very weird. But again, hey, it's a technical notion. I can make it what I want. So this is going to be lurking in the background as I go on and talk about work immersiveness. This is how I'm thinking about works in this broad and Waltonian way. And the nice thing about it is it lets me think about works as basically ascribing prescriptions to make-believe. It sets up things that engagers are supposed to do, users are supposed to do. And now we can grade how well the prop helps you. So, this lets me go to my second bit. Let's think about immersiveness and immersive features. Oh, it's only three. I think I said four before. It was only three. So the first thing about immersiveness, and this seems just blatantly obvious to me, is it is subjective. A work can be immersive for one user, might not be so for another. a really easy example here. Much like Robbie Williams, I have aphantasia, right? So I don't have any visual imagination. So I find like really descriptive literature just annoying. Because I'm not imagining a setting or how a character looks, I'm just like, just get that plot. Whereas, you know, if you don't, some people find these sorts of things really immersive, drawing you in. That's easy. Similarly, I think this just seems like a bad, obvious bit of data. Immersiveness is contextual or temporal. That is, a user can find a work immersive in one point in time or context and not in another. Easy one is, if you're reading a book you really love, but you're doing it because you're annoyed and stuck in the airport, you're not really engaged with the work, you're kind of just passing the time. And the last one, I think this is the biggest one, and this sort of came up earlier. It just seems like such a datum, but it's very weird, because a lot of the accounts of imaginative immersion don't allow for this. Immersiveness clearly comes in degrees. Things can be more or less immersive. Indeed, if we just look at a lot of the talk about AR and VR, VR in particular, people say things like, VR is more immersive than video games. And then you have a big story about why. That only makes sense if we already have a kind of graded notion. Shocker. So okay, immersiveness is subjective, it's kind of contextual, temporal, and it's graded, it comes in degrees. What this means is that any story we're going to tell is always going to have a bunch of riders on it. For a user, at a time, to the degree. I want to flag that up, I am not going to mention this stuff again. Oh well, I'll remind you. But when I'm talking about ways of being immersive, I'm not going to wheel this stuff back in. But remember, it's always there. So it's always relativized, it's always graded, blah, 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 blah. Okay, everybody with me so far? Good enough. So the last thing, the last thing to talk about is this idea that immersiveness or immersion comes in what I'll call different flavors. That's not the best term, but it's what I like. What I mean by that is I think there's fundamentally different types of immersive experiences. Now this is something I am taking from that kind of immersive experience literature. So I'm going to butcher these names. Myra and Ermi have a fairly infamous SCI model. This is used all over the shop in game studies. And this is meant to kind of give you three different types of immersive experiences. So they have sensory immersive experiences, challenge ones, and imaginative. Sensory ones are the kind that I think most people think of when they talk about immersion. It's literally just kind of they talk about it as perceptual saturation. This is the kind of thing that my mom had. Right? The visual field was just so overstimulated, she was immersed. It doesn't have to be purely visual, it can be other things too. So the second one, a challenge immersive experience, this is basically the notion of flow. Are people familiar with this from sports science or anything like this? Right, so this is when you get caught up in an activity, and the only thing you really think about is like what you're doing within that activity. A lot of people talk about rock climbing here. I do not do any rock climbing, so that's just an experience entirely alien to me. But this is also the same kind of thing you probably get when you're doing your philosophy. Right? You get in the flow. And then finally, you have imaginative immersive experiences. These are harder to pin down, but I think probably the best elucidation of this is in narratology, where they talk about transportation. So the idea here isn't that it's sensory. It's not a kind of stimulating the visual or the auditory senses or anything like this. It's being transported into something like a fictional world. Again, in narratology, there's a lot of talk about transportation. It can be described in terms of you doing some imaginative work to construct an image, right? But that's this helping you do this, right? That's kind of the imaginative one first, and then maybe you get some sensory ones too. Okay. Now again, I like this model. I think this is really good, but it's all about users. It's not about the stuff. So I want to take this and flip it and think about, right, immersiveness, work immersiveness. And I really like these, but I don't think they quite match up to the way that works can be. So what I want to talk about, last little bit here, is talk about five ways that I think works can be immersive. Again, they kind of line up with those three, but not quite. So I'll list them, then we'll go through them one by one. We have perceptual, what I'll call worldly, narrative, mechanical, and agential. I should say, some of these I'm just taking from other people, especially perceptual narrative. The rest are terminology I've pulled out of the air. I'm very bad at terminology, so if you have other suggestions, I'd be very happy. So what's notable, and I'll say this now, we'll come back to this as we go through them, is that a works media type will impact how much of each form of immersiveness is even capable of delivering. That should be obvious, but it's worth just saying. And remember, I'm going to talk about these just flatly, but there's always all those riders. For a user, at a time, to a degree, blah, blah, blah. Not going to talk about it, but it's there in the background. Okay, so what's perceptual immersiveness? Well, that's basically just the sensorial one, right? This is when the work's features make it easy for the user to satisfy relevant, broadly perceptual prescriptions to make move. So, for example, we have this one. I think this is from Nissan. I don't remember. Right? It's basically an instance where you can take apart one of their engines. Right? I think this is a nice paradigmatic example of kind of like a certain form of perceptual immersiveness. So the idea here is that work's going to have properties like vividness, verisimilitude, perspective manipulation. Come back to some of the Loy stuff. Maybe just sheer size. If we think about certain forms of visual art, color richness or distribution, these various features, the words can have formal features as I pick them out, but they don't have to be formal. Now, when we think about this, VR is paradigmatically perceptually immersive because of just the way it works. You strap it to your face, and it takes over everything. Literature, in contrast, is the low end of this. And that's just because, put really frankly, the thing that you're engaged with is just some ink on the page. It will describe a situation for you that you can then imagine. So, I mean, Tolkien is famously said to be, at least in some instances, have a very rich, immersive world. I think that's a different kind. I'm going to talk about it in just a second. The one exception, and I say the low end, because there's still room, is there are some books that are explicitly about reading. And when they basically do things on the page to talk about what it's like to see certain things on the page, well then bam, it's actually a high version of this perceptual immersiveness. Very rare, but it's there. Happy to talk about that more. Okay, so there's perceptual immersiveness. Here's the second one. This is what we'll call worldly immersiveness. Worldly immersiveness is when the work makes the user feel like there's a make-believable other world. That it's out there and it's going on and it's taking place more than just in your little sphere of access. Warren Spector, who is a game designer, puts it this way, right? You're there, nothing stands between you and belief that you're in an alternate world. And he's not talking about this in a perception term. He's talking about it as like, the people who are there have their lives. They do stuff. So this is where you can get it with descriptive world building. This is what I think literature is quite good at. In video games, you get it with NPC behavior groups. So probably the best example of this kind of thing are immersive sims. Like where the NPCs will go around and do their own thing. They seem to have a life of their own. Similarly, environmental storytelling, again, immersive sims are a wonderful example here. Diegetic music and lighting effects, these are the kinds of things, again, you make the imaginer, the user, feel like there's a whole other world there. Of course, it's always going to use sensory stuff to kind of do the input, but it's different than the perceptual thing, right? The perceptual thing is literally just what you see is what you get. This is, there's actually another world out there, and it's rich and deep and more nuanced. Famous things that break this are stuff like, oh, invisible walls. Right? Oh, you can't go over to those mountains because there's just an invisible wall where the world sort of ends. Or, it's very hard to do, but I've seen some people in Minecraft literally get to the end of the world, and it's just a blank void, and that's it. That's the kind of thing that breaks the world of universes. Okay, so there's our first two. Here's our third one. Narrative immersiveness. This is pretty straightforward, I think. This is when basically you're caught up in the story. The work makes the user care about what happens in the narrative or about characters and set. Note, non-narrative works cannot do this. So that's easy. Basically, the idea here is I want to know what happens. My wife and I are watching the TV show Lucifer. Have people seen that show? It's not a very good show. It's kind of fun in its way. But my God, we want to know what happens. We finish an episode and we're like, we've got to watch another one. Even though we're not really kind of invested in it, we're narratively caught up in it. We want to see what the story is, how it works. So the works to do this, we're going to have strong narrative arcs, character development, rich storytelling, if it's the kind of thing that has a good acting, good voice acting, etc., etc., etc. Again, the thing to note is the prompt, the work, has to have narrative aspects. If it's non-narrative, ain't gonna do it. So Beat Saber is incredibly immersive in some ways, but it is not narratively immersive, I think. So what kind of way is Beat Saber immersive? Well, there's maybe a perceptual one. Here's the way I think it's very immersive, mechanically. So mechanical immersiveness is when the work's mechanisms either induce a kind of flow state, like the dude who was just going nuts with the Beat Sabers, right? Or they reinforce other higher level aesthetic features. So I'll give an example to kind of support this. Are people familiar with the game Papers, Please? It's a great game, right? So you play a low level bureaucrat who's stationed at a kind of entry booth at a kind of Soviet bloc country. And the whole game loop is designed to reinforce this idea of doing a really banal, boring job where you have this oppressive regime kind of constantly changing the rules on you and people desperate to get in or desperate to get out. And the game loop is perfect for this. So you just have this little tiny area and you have all these documents people are giving you and you have to like shuffle them around to make sure and check for forgeries and do all of these things. And then of course, again, the regime constantly changes the rules. Oh, are you supposed to have a certificate? Oh, does it need a stamp on it? Oh, crap, okay. And of course, if you don't do it right, you get fired. So what this game has is effectively an amazing mechanical loop that drives home the overarching aesthetic feature. This is the kind of thing that I'm after with like mechanical immersiveness. The mechanism immerses you into the aesthetic feature of the work. In some ways, you might think of this as mechanical immersiveness getting into something like worldly immersiveness. So this is something you get with gameplay loops, appropriately tuned controls and difficulty levels. Notably, non-interactive media forms can't deliver this kind of immersiveness because it requires mechanisms, affordances. Not the sort of thing that like traditional literature has. Another really good case of this kind of thing is Longbow. I think Neil's going to talk to you a little bit about this in a few minutes. Longbow is great because, I don't know if you can see in the corner there, when you play Longbow, you fire the Longbow by actually drawing and letting go. So it's, again, the very motion that you make, I think, helps immerse you in the game in this kind of way. The design of the work is immersive in that way, again, in this mechanical way. Now, the last one is sort of weird, And I think just between friends, it's technically a form of mechanical immersion, but it's somewhere between the narrative and the mechanical. And this is agential. And I've called it agential basically stealing it from Team Wynn. And the idea here is that the works of affordances allow users to substantially change the nature and content of the fictional work by taking up a role. So here's the thought. Tabletop role-playing games, live-action role-playing games. These are exactly the kind of thing I have in mind here. Where basically users are a character in the game. Possibly more than one, but at least one. And by doing that, they become immersed, not necessarily in the narrative, because it might not be a very good narrative, but they're immersed in their character. Using themselves as a kind of supplementary prop. I think we can characterize this more fully in terms of the notion of force choice and completeness that Rich Woodward and I have talked about. I'm happy to talk about that in Q&A if you're interested. Again, no, non-interactive media can't deliver this kind of immersiveness because you have to have the right kind of affordances. So those are the five. And I think different media types are going to give you different amounts, versions of these. And thinking about them is going to help us better understand work immersiveness abroad. Of course, I've pulled them apart, but works inevitably are going to have mixtures of them. You're not really going to get just one. That's just, you know, conceptual distinctions, blah, 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 right? And media types are going to have certain kinds of favors here. Literature's often highly worldly and narratively immersive, and often, not always, bad literature is still literature. But scores very badly with regards to perceptual immersiveness, again, because of the kind of things I was talking about before. Don't confuse the perceptual with what I was calling the world. Many video games are going to score highly on all fronts, though it's usually a trade-off between which of the forms a game emphasizes. Is it going to be mechanically driven? Is it going to be narratively driven? The best ones are both, but of course, the best ones are very rare. And VR tends to be highly perceptually, worldly, and mechanically immersive, tends to be, but pretty poor with regards to narrative and interactive. That's just because of the kind of nature of most VR apps. Yeah. Not strict, it's a tends to. Okay. So far, so good. Last thing that I want to talk about is some fun cases. Two. First one is about fourth wall breaks. So this is something my colleague Naylor van der Musselaar and I are working on. Naylor's basically writing a book on this. So fourth wall breaks, everyone familiar with that kind of thing? Right, where the character kind of like, not always the character, but something happens that sort of breaks down the invisible wall that separates the audience from what's going on inside the world of fiction. It's from theater originally, but it comes up with a name. So this happens when the work is a property that reminds the user they're engaged with the work and these will tell you the terms. Reminds you, hey, you're playing a game of make-believe. You're reading a book. You're watching a play. These often break forms of immersion. Often. And you can see it in different kinds. So in perceptual cases, the kind of chunkiness we were talking about with VR might be a really obvious case. If the images or things get distorted, if there's a glitch or a bug. Worldly breaks can happen. This is often really bad with older video games when you have pop-in. So like you're walking along and then suddenly like, oh, and there's a tree right next to me that just magically appeared because the draw distance was too short. Narrative cases happen a lot. My favorite example here is Oblivion, which is a very fun role-playing game. The problem is they gave all of the NPCs dialogue, so they'll kind of just talk amongst themselves if you leave them. There's only like 10 pieces of NPC dialogue amongst them. So it's very, very weird to see people constantly like, lovely weather we're having today. Lovely weather we're having today. It breaks the feeling of any kind of narrative. Mechanical ones happen all the time. A lovely quote from Susky here reviewing Star Fox Zero, right, where the controls basically fight it. And agential, this kind of happens, I think, with ludonarrative dissonance, or when a game takes away the character. So this is something I think Metal Gear Solid, for example, is famous for doing, where the characterizing stuff happens in a cutscene when you don't have any control. But it doesn't always break the immersion. Sometimes fourth wall breaks actually heighten immersion. So I think there's a couple cases with this. My favorite example is the very end of Spec Ops: The Line, spoilers. You confront the big baddie, and he talks to you and says, look, this is all your fault. Importantly, it's kind of hard to see because of the crappy screenshot here, he points the gun, but the gun is not pointed at the character, the gun is pointed at the camera. Like, if you actually look at the scene inside the game, character's over there, he's pointing the gun at the camera. He's talking to the player, saying this is your fault. And this ties up to things throughout the game, when in loading screens it talks to the player and says, do you feel like a hero? This is the kind of thing that actually reinforces the relevance of immersion this game is after. Same things with Doki Doki Literature Club. I'm not going to spoil that game, you should go and play it. There's a scene where, well, basically, everything gets stripped away and one of the characters talks directly to the player. And that heightens the immersion, reminds you that you've been playing this very weird game. And why are you playing this game? Who are you? Why are you doing this? And I think the same kind of thing happens with games like Baba Is You, another great game I would very much suggest playing, where the game is predicated around changing the rules of the game as you go. So there's a kind of constant fourth wall breaking. And I think actually this kind of thing is to be expected given a broadly Waltonian story. Because remember, in the Waltonian story, the very first move, we were talking about this yesterday, the very first move is that you have to kind of make believe that you're in the world with these things. You're seeing these things. That's the very first step. And what this one, for example, the Spec Ops, the Line one is doing, is reminding you of that. I love that. So fourth wall breaks, I think, fit with this framework really nicely. The good ones, and it explains why they're good. Here's the other one, and again, I told you it would come back to my mom. So remember, I started with what happened with my mom when she was on the cliff edge. And here's my story. I think the work that she was engaged with was, at least for her at the time, extremely perceptually immersive. So much so that it overwhelmed her rational capacity to do a kind of quarantining. So I think there's two ways to cash this out. I prefer the second one, but I think both of them work. The first one is, there's a kind of spillover. She had this stuff in the make-believe box, and she was doing the make-believe, being guided by the work immersiveness. But the work immersiveness was so high that it kind of spilled over from the make-believe box into the belief box. Another way to go, and I think this is my preferred way, is the work was so immersive it basically triggers a kind of Eve. And this is something that's worth thinking about, right? Because what this suggests is, I'll call it a danger, but works can be too immersive. It can lead to either forming beliefs or having A-leaves, which might be problematic, or maybe even facilitate certain problematic real-world actions. And the lurking kind of issue here is there's a danger to designers striving to make the work too immersive. They want the works to be super immersive, so they make it more and more realistic in whatever way that's relevant, and they might do it too much. So this is really funny. You talked about the sword thing yesterday. I, honest to God, I had this example in here beforehand, right? Which is, if we want to make a prop sword really immersive, what can we do? Make it into a fucking sword. And then it's going to be really immersive. It's going to be dangerous, because it is. So I think that's the kind of thing, again, that's driven by this theory, or at least explained by this sort of theory of work immersiveness. Okay, so, wrapping up. No idea how I'm doing for time, we'll figure it out. Right? I think we should ask questions about work immersiveness, kind of flipping around from focus on individuals and cognitive states, Immersiveness, as I understand it, relational contextual common degrees. I think the Waltonian account lets us define notions in terms of how the props support or facilitate or prescribe make-believe in various forms. And I think that immersiveness comes in different forms. I talked about five. Don't think this is exhaustive, but I think it's a good way to start. So yeah, thank you guys very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.